Stuart is a man who needs no introduction. Stuart is a man who is asked for no introduction. Please join me in welcoming Stuart Lennery to us.
Thank you for this invitation to speak to you. I'm going to talk about two books. And part of the reason I'm talking about two books is I was writing one book and it went wrong. It became much too long and ended up as two books, these two that you can see here. One of which is published, Foucault's Last Decade, and the other one will be out probably in January next year. And these books came about because I was interested in how a number of publications that have appeared since Foucault's death have shed, I think, a great deal of light on what Foucault was trying to do, and that I was particularly interested in the last period of his work, particularly the period from 1974 until 1984. We know from Foucault's partner, Daniel Defer, from a letter that Defer quotes, that Foucault finished writing Discipline and Punish, and then on that same day started writing The History of Sexuality, Volume 1. I might take the evening off, but this allows us to very precisely date when Foucault began writing The History of Sexuality, Volume 1, on the 26th of August, 1974. Foucault died on the 25th of June, 1984, and that is the last decade of this title. So it's from the beginning of the writing of The History of Sexuality through to the moment when, at Foucault's death, that series of books remains incomplete. So I started off thinking, well, I'm going to write this and it's going to be a study of that very particular period. But I felt that I needed to do some introduction to that period. And so that was the original first two chapters of the plan. This was the book as I'd originally planned it, as I originally got a contract for a book. And that this was going to do a little bit of work on the early 1970s in order to set up the problems that I think Foucault was trying to engage with from 1974 and then through a whole range of changes until his death in 1984. And the book, as I said, became much too long, and I ended up reconfiguring the material, and I'll talk a little bit about that towards the end. When Foucault published the first volume of The History of Sexuality, this is a book that came out in December 1976, was submitted to the publisher in August 1976. French publication schedules are much quicker than anything we're familiar with in the Anglophone world. 4 months from submission of a manuscript, which of course was a typewritten manuscript, which had to be rekeyed before it could be published. But then 4 months later would be published. So Foucault, in late 1976, says this first volume of The History of Sexuality is going to introduce a sequence of volumes. And he outlines in the book, in passages in the book, of which one is here, and also on the back cover of early editions of the book, what those subsequent volumes will be. So this is volume one, this is an introduction, and he says the domain that we must analyse and the different studies that will follow the present volume is that dispositif of sexuality, the dispositif meaning something like the arrangement or the setup or the apparatus, the kind of organisation of both practices and knowledges at a particular moment. Its formation, he says, on the basis of the Christian notion of the flesh, so this will be the second volume, and then its deployment through four great strategies that were deployed in the 19th century, the sexualization of children, the hystericization of women, the specification of the perverse, and the regulation of populations. And that's what he's going to do in the next five volumes. The second volume will be on Christianity, particularly in the late medieval through to the early modern period, so around the time of the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation, and then four volumes on what he calls the constituent subjects of sexuality: the masturbating child, the hysterical woman, the perverse adult, and the what he calls at one point the Malthusian couple, the idea of how biology and race intersect in this idea of the breeding of the people that are having reproducing children into the next generation. Foucault also says in The History of Sexuality 1 that there will be another volume outside of the series on the power of truth, which will look at the question of confession, like the volume on Christianity, the second volume, but it will look at confession in more juridical practice, in legal practice, the idea of confessing to a crime as opposed to confessing your sins. And Foucault publishes none of those volumes. None of the five volumes that he promises that will continue the History of Sexuality series, and not this separate volume on the power of truth. Instead, in 1984, right at the end of his life, two further volumes of the History of Sexuality are published. And these are on completely different subject matter and completely different historical period to what he'd suggested. One book, The Use of Pleasures, is on Greek antiquity, so classical Greek antiquity, and the second is on the care of the self, which is on the Hellenistic period of Greece, or a later period of Greek antiquity, and Rome at the period of the late Republic, early Empire. Completely different historical period, completely different questions that Foucault is interested in. And there's a fourth volume that he says is forthcoming. This is when these books are published. The second volume is published in May 1984, the third volume in June 1984, and then Foucault, as I said, dies on June the 25th, 1984. So this fourth volume, which we know that Foucault had a complete typescript, which gives us an indication of how late it was. Foucault wrote all of his books by hand and then had them typed up by Collège de France typists. So there was a typescript that Foucault was correcting in the very last illness in May and June 1984. Foucault says to various people in 1984 he anticipates that fourth volume will be out in October. He thinks it's very close to being completed, and it's only that final illness that prevents him from delivering it to the publisher. When Foucault died, they interpreted a document that he had left as his legal will, and this said very clearly, no posthumous publications. At the time, they interpreted that very strictly, and so that fourth volume was not published at the time and has still not been published. I know where it is, but I can't access it. No researchers have been given access to that volume, so in a sense, it's the kind of the missing kind of holy grail of Foucault's studies is that fourth volume of The History of Sexuality. There's only two people I know who have actually looked at it, one of whom confessed he hasn't actually read it. One is Foucault's partner, who was left in Foucault's apartment when Foucault died. The other one is Foucault's nephew, who, having retired from his job as a banker, has now taken over the literary execution of his uncle's estate. So, in a sense, what I'm trying to do is, how did Foucault get from that first thematic plan that he proposed in the mid-1970s to this historical plan that he was working on at the time that he died in 1984? How did he move from one project to another? What were the various steps that Foucault took to get to that? Now, that's become a lot easier to narrate, to tell that story, because of the publication of Foucault's lecture courses. Foucault taught at the Collège de France in Paris from 1970 until his death in 1984, just a couple of months before he died, was giving some of his final lectures. And those lecture courses, which are research courses, professors there are not teaching students, they are giving research courses that are there for people to listen to. Nobody takes exams, there's no coursework or anything that's involved in that. And the professors there are contracted to give 26 hours of teaching a year, of which no more than half can be seminars. And for the first 10 years of that period, Foucault gave about half as lectures and about half as a parallel seminar. I'll say a little bit about that parallel seminar later. In the last few years, Foucault gave up on the seminar for various reasons and decided to give double the number of lectures in the class. And so the hermeneutic of the subject course is double the length of any of the others. Unfortunately, by the time he comes to the last of the volumes, Foucault is so ill, several classes are cancelled. He begins one course a couple of weeks late and so on. So those volumes are actually shorter. But Foucault had the expectation that he was going to move to give more lectures a year towards the end of his life. Now, the lectures have all now been published in French, but two are still not translated into English. But this number sequence at the bottom is the order in which they were published. So instead of publishing them in chronological order, they jumped around in terms of the sequence. I think that this has made it very difficult to see both the continuity of concerns and also the emergence of new concerns in Foucault's work. I think reading the courses in the order that they were delivered gives us an insight into them that reading them in the order they were published didn't allow. Now, why did they publish them in odd sequence? Part of this is to do with assigning editors to a block of courses. So, for example, Frédéric Breau edited the last four courses, Michel Senelard did the courses on governmentality in the late 1970s, and these often meant that the editors did one volume at a time and they were working in parallel, so they staggered the sequence of publication. But more seriously, there were problems with the first three courses in terms of what material that they could use. Initially, what they decided to get around the no posthumous publications stipulation was that they would transcribe the tape recordings that had been archived at the time. Because these tape recordings were in the public domain, they were in the Collège de France library, they were in various archives in Berkeley and in Paris, they could transcribe the tapes and therefore make what was already available more widely accessible. And legally, this was seen as the way that they could get around that problem. As they went through the publication, they supplemented the transcription of the recording more and more with manuscript material, the manuscripts Foucault used when he walked into the lecture room to give the lectures. And the reason that the first three courses were some of the last to be published was because there were no tape recordings of those early courses. With the Punitive Society course from 1972-73, they found that the archive copy had actually had the next year's course taped over the top of it, and so that there was no record of that in the archive. And with the first two courses, there was nothing that they could find. Now, go back a little bit in history. What was a portable tape recorder at this time? Many of us remember dictaphones. Some of us remember those slightly larger cassette players. And then if you go back to the early 1970s, and these would have been much more cumbersome things to take around. These were in no sense portable. So for those early courses, and some courses I'll mention later, before the Collège de France, there are no recordings. So as they relaxed this no posthumous publications stipulation, they went back and they said, well, actually, maybe we can publish Foucault's manuscript that he took into the lecture room. With the first two courses, that is what they did, and those are very cryptic because, as many of us, Foucault didn't go in with fully worked out every sentence that he would then read verbatim. He would improvise and elaborate around points. With the third course, what they found was that Foucault himself had had a transcription made, presumably before they taped over the tapes, and that they were able to use Foucault's corrected transcription from the recordings as the basis for the course. So there's complications in terms of the materiality of the record and in terms of interpretation of those materials. Now, the reason I think the lecture courses are so interesting is that we can use the lecture courses to see how Foucault was developing ideas that he would later work through into book publication. If you read the first volume, you can see that Foucault is trying out some of the ideas that go into that first volume, and as I suggest in the book, many of the projected volumes, the volumes he thought he would write in the mid to late 1970s, in some of these courses from the mid-1970s, so at the very time that he's writing the material. And then when we come to the two subsequent volumes that were actually published and the one that was very close to publication, we can see in Foucault's lectures that he's trying out material in these research lecture courses that is intended to be used in the book publications. The closest is this one from 1981, Subjectivity and Truth, not yet translated, which is very close to the material that's in the Care of the Self volume. It's almost like a draft of the book. With the 1982 course, The Hermeneutic of the Subject, it's a similar time period and it's many of the same authors, but it's with a different set of concerns. So it's clearly that Foucault's working on this period, but he's doing two sort of parallel projects around this. And my surmise, which I think is based on a good sense of what Foucault was trying to do with this book on Christianity, is that the 1980 course, The Government of the Living, tries out some of the material that would have related to that course. Various indications about when Foucault says, this is what I intend to treat in that book, are found in that lecture course. Now, the dates of these go in the reverse order to the way the books are. And this is, in a sense, how historians often work. They begin from a period that they're relatively familiar with, they work backwards, but then when they present it and tell the story, they narrate it chronologically forwards. So Foucault, in 1980, drafted what at the time was going to be the second volume of the History of Sexuality, on the Early Church and Confession. And then he says at one point, but I realised that the introduction to that book traded on a number of clichés I'd got from the secondary literature about pagan antiquity, and I was unhappy with that material, and so therefore I put that draft aside and went further back historically into antiquity in order to rewrite that material and to elaborate that into what becomes these two books. So the lecture courses then give us, I think, a very clear sense of some of the things that Foucault was interested in at different times, what he was reading, what he was thinking, how he was trying ideas out. None of them replicate strictly, but they do give us an indication. If we look at the period, so the last decade, but also the immediately preceding period, what we have with Foucault is a number of different registers in which Foucault was working, of which the lecture courses are an enormously important part. I've had to do this by abbreviation, so I'll explain these. Archaeology of Knowledge, a book published in 1969, Discipline and Punish in 75, History of Sexuality 1, and History of Sexuality 2 and 3. So those are the major publications from Foucault's period. The first thing that really got me interested in thinking about how we might fill in the gaps in that story was the publication in 1994, so this was the first year of my PhD, on Foucault's shorter writings, a French collection called Die Écrits, Talks and Writings, something of that nature, that was a collection of everything that Foucault had published in his lifetime that was not in one of his books. So this was all of the journal articles, all of the book chapters, all of the interviews, all of the press conferences, all of the roundtable discussions, all of those short writings, no matter what language they'd originally been published in, were put back into this collection in French. And the French version ordered things chronologically by date of first publication. So this was able to reconstruct, the first volume begins in 1954, and then these volumes across this timeline, filling in an enormous amount of detail about what Foucault was doing at those times. Unfortunately, the English translation is only a fraction of that material, and it's thematically ordered rather than chronologically ordered. So it gives a very different sense, I think, of what Foucault was doing. The lecture courses then, I mentioned, are all the College de France courses that run through this period and help us to give an insight into what Foucault's research was at the time. And then a number of lecture courses that he gave elsewhere that have been published. So Truth and Juridical Forms from Rio in 1973, some lectures on medicine also in Rio 74, the Wrongdoing Truth-Telling lectures from Levin in 1981, Technologies of the Self in Vermont in the US in 1982, and the Fearless Speech lectures on Parisia in Berkeley in 1983. So again, another kind of layer of Foucault's research teaching in various places, and a number of short lectures as well that go in there. There's also, and this is strangely neglected because all of these were published in Foucault's lifetime, all of the collaborative and co-authored studies that Foucault was involved in. There were some of these that came out of his College de France seminar, some of which came out of other research projects. The Pierre Riviere collection is one that came out of the first 3 years of Foucault's seminar. A number of reports and publications that I'll say a bit more about later, through to a co-authored book with the historian Arlette Farge in 1982 on family disorder, which is now finally going to be translated into English. It'll come out with University of Minnesota Press. And then there's also Foucault's political activism with the Prison Information Group and the Health Information Group in the early 1970s. And that's something else that I tried to add into this story. So the point of this is these kind of different layers or different registers of work that Foucault was involved in at different times and different places, and how these can help us to fit together a particular kind of story. So some of the things that I did in order to write this book, one of the first things that I did, and I kept updating it as I was working on it over the time I was working on the project, was to build a very detailed chronology. Now, Daniel Defer, Foucault's partner, provides one of these in the collection of Foucault's short writings, but I added in the dates of every interview that I could find, the dates of every lecture, when Foucault was travelling in different places, when he gave a press conference, when there was a news report about what he was doing, and just kept adding in more and more detail, in part so I could read these different registers of work in relation to each other. So that if Foucault was giving a lecture at the College de France on the Middle Ages in the morning, but he was giving a press conference on the contemporary situation in French prisons that afternoon, you could read these two texts together, and that sometimes connections would come up that wouldn't be obvious if you didn't read them in that way. I did, and I'm not going to bore you with the details, I did a huge amount of really quite close-grained textual analysis of sitting with, if Foucault published a book chapter in a journal before the publication of the book, sitting with both texts and checking every instance of a change between those two texts, which could be revealing in terms of inflections of vocabulary, and so on. I spent an enormous amount of time on that. I did a lot of work finding the original versions of texts. Although Die Écrits is an enormously valuable resource, it sometimes loses a bit of the contextualising information from original publication, and some of the texts were originally published in places that were very difficult to find. Some of you know that my role here the first couple of years took me to Monash for a while and to New York University. Well, I annoyed interlibrary loan staff on three continents tracking down some of these texts, but I did eventually find all of the ones that I needed for this work. But some of these were published in very peculiar publications, and but this often helped with information to situate that. I spent quite a lot of time looking at old newspapers, often on microfilm, at the Bibliothèque Nationale and at the British Library, particularly for the second book, which talks more about Foucault's activism in the early 1970s, of what was being reported in Le Monde about an event that Foucault had taken part in the day, for example. And a lot of this material was useful for me, and then it maybe ended up as one footnote or something in the published book. So I put a lot of resource material up on my personal blog, and produced a bibliography that Foucault Studies published, which was all of the short writings that didn't appear in the French collection. There were about 100 that I found that had appeared in various sources, some of which illegally, some of which legally and had been missed. But a number of texts that I thought were interesting, and because I'd made the effort to do that for myself, I thought other people might find this useful. I also spent a lot of time in archives, and I'm not going to say a huge amount about this, but I tried to do this work as a more traditional kind of historian might approach these questions, rather than the idea of a kind of armchair theorist approaching these kind of issues. The Foucault archive at the Bibliothèque Nationale until very recently only comprised 5 boxes. These were boxes of material that Foucault's partner, Daniel Defer, gave them not long after Foucault's death, that comprised an early draft of The Archaeology of Knowledge, which frankly would be better described as a book with the same title, or a draft with the same title on completely different material. It's very, very different from the one that was actually published. But I think that has something to do with the materiality of material. If you've got to write everything out again longhand, you don't have quite the same situation to the precise words or the precise organisation of material as you write a next longhand draft of the book. I think if we're editing with word processing, then it makes it a very different model of how you work with it. Because the other volumes show that very, very clearly. The reason I was looking at them was because I'd been told that there was a draft of History of Sexuality, volumes 2 and 3, when that was still a single volume, single manuscript. What I found in the other 4 boxes of this collection was actually successive drafts of every chapter that goes into volumes 2 and 3, multiple drafts of each chapter. And some of the materiality of this was very interesting to me. As I said, Foucault wrote everything longhand and then would give these poor typists at the Collège de France a version that they had to type up, and then he would annotate that, and then that would go through various stages of iteration. But he would also do old-fashioned, literal cut and paste. He would cut a typed few lines, glue it to a new sheet of paper, write some linking parts, glue another piece there, and then that would be the version that would go to the next typist. All of this was preserved, and so you could see the transition of material as it worked through with that. There's also a large collection of Foucault-related material, and particularly collaborative work and relating to the prison information group at the IMEC archive in Normandy. And then Berkeley also has a collection of Foucault material. Foucault taught at Berkeley between 1975 and 1984. And there's material that's been collected and maintained at Berkeley. There's some overlap between the Berkeley collection and the IMEC collection, but I used all of that material. And then right at the end of the writing of Foucault's last decade, in which I use much more in the second book, a much larger collection of material was sold to the Bibliothèque Nationale. Now, I said there were 5 boxes of material in the early collection. There's 110 boxes in this collection, of which about 40 are available to researchers at this point. I've been through about 30 of them. The ones I haven't are the ones that are related to different periods of Foucault's work than the ones I've written about. And these, at the moment, largely comprise Foucault's reading notes, the notes that he took when he was writing his lectures, when he was writing his books, from other things that he was reading, some photocopied material, but largely handwritten notes. And pictures like this of Foucault, and you can see these folders at the front of his desk, those are the folders that you now get in the Bibliothèque Nationale. Now, these notes are fascinating, but they're also incredibly frustrating. The main frustration is they're completely undated, and they're all organised thematically. So, while I can tell, because I know when Foucault lectured about things or when he wrote about things, roughly what period some of the notes might be from, I would love to have been able to do it the other way around. When Foucault was reading something first and how that then later came into publications or lectures. And the other challenge is Foucault's handwriting. That's actually one of the neater pages. That's a page the Collège de France, the Bibliothèque Nationale has actually made available. This is a page of notes on Immanuel Kant's essay on the different human races that Foucault was reading for The Order of Things around 1964. But Foucault's handwriting was very, very difficult to read. He also uses abbreviations, a kind of shorthand that took me a little bit of time to work out, particularly because he uses Greek letters to abbreviate French words. So the Greek letter psi means psychology, the Greek letter theta means theology, delta means God, these kinds of things. So that took a while. When I worked that out, that helped. But Foucault's handwriting is hard work. And that obviously took me quite a bit of time. I mentioned some of the collaborative projects that Foucault was involved with. Some of these were in relation to Félix Guattari's research institute, the CERFI Research Institute. And there were some books that were published, and then there were a number of other things that were much harder to find, either reports that were published but without an ISBN and without kind of a cataloguing system, so even libraries were difficult to locate these. Secondhand bookstores and the internet made that a lot easier in the end of collecting these. But they got, this is Guattari, Foucault, Deleuze and some of their colleagues, they got a lot of money from the French state to do research. And they planned a number of projects around the notion of, the French term is équipement, utilities or public infrastructure or something of that nature, where they're trying to look at the way that different kinds of organisations of public space, public utilities, schools, hospitals and so on. And a lot of these themes appear in Foucault's work, but a lot of this was done by researchers, many of whom were in his Collège de France seminar, many of whom were funded by these projects. And there were five projects that they planned to do, and there are detailed files on all of those projects archived at EMEC, which is now in Normandy. It used to be in Paris, but is now in Normandy. And that material of trying to tell a story of Foucault through the connection to researchers that were part of teams that he and others assembled is something that I try and tell him in both books, of to try in a sense to decenter Foucault from this sort of isolated intellectual superstar to somebody who was working with a number of other people in research projects that he was interested in, and so on. And the EMEC archive now is in this amazing place. This was actually flattened in the Second World War and they've rebuilt it. This is in Caen in Normandy. And they've converted the Abbey into a research residential archive and a residential conference centre. You stay in the old monks' dormitories, you eat it collectively in the refectory, and the old Abbey building itself is the converted into the archive. In December, this is actually one of the coldest places on the planet. Partly because they keep the room temperature low because of the manuscripts and all the material, but also because of the vast size of this building. It's an exposed area not far from the coast in Normandy. And you go there, you have to go there and stay there because it's so far from the town that you wouldn't be able to stay in the town and get between the two if you didn't have your own transport and so on. So a number of those collaborative books, and I did manage to get hold of copies of just about all of these. And these, I think, give another sense to the Foucault as the individual and tell us a little bit about what Foucault was doing in his research seminars, how he was building research teams to look into things, many of which then filter through into his lecture courses, into his publications, and so on. I'm not going to go through these in detail, but there are some unpublished texts that Foucault at least had a hand in that have never been catalogued, have never been... so these are anonymous texts, but you can tell that Foucault was clearly involved in some of those texts in here. I also talked to some of the people that knew Foucault. This is Daniel Defer, Foucault's partner, who still lives in Foucault's old apartment. These are the bookshelves you can see in Foucault's many of the photographs of Foucault. And I'd met Defer several times at conferences, but this was the first time I had a really long conversation with him. And also that, you know, the Foucault group, he goes to Foucault's old apartment. There was an element of that as an appeal for me to go there. But he was fascinating and really helpful to me in terms of saying, you know, the reason that Foucault was interested in this because he was reading this literature or he was talking to this person. Those kind of connections were very helpful. And in terms of the activist work on prisons and on health, Defer was also actively involved there. He was a sociologist by training. He's about 10 years younger than Foucault. But he was also actively involved as a political activist and actually got Foucault involved in political activism. So he was an important person for me to talk to about those kinds of questions. The other main group of people I talked to were those people that were in the audience when Foucault gave these lectures. This was a lecture course he gave in Berkeley in October to November 1983. That was published originally as a privately circulated typewritten and photocopied transcript that then appeared with a semi-text as a book called Fearless Speech and has just appeared in French as a proper critical edition. The problem we have is we have an English version, and Foucault gave these lectures in English, but an English version that's inaccurate and an accurate French version that's a translation. So one of the things I'm talking to publishers about at the moment is to use the two and the tape recordings and the manuscripts to do a proper English critical edition, in other words, one that's actually in the language that Foucault gave the lectures, but makes use of the critical apparatus of the French edition of that. But alongside that group that met for Foucault's lectures, there was also a group of students who met with Foucault at Paul Rabinow's house just near campus in Berkeley, where they were planning work that they were going to do, they thought, over the next few years when Foucault kept coming back as a visiting lecturer. Now, this is a picture that comes from Didier Erebon's biography of Foucault. I did actually get a much better quality colour photograph, which was taken a few moments later. And I have spoken to most of the people in this picture, apart from the ones that are no longer alive. And these were interesting because it gave a sense of what Foucault was trying to do as collaborative research. Foucault and some of these students planned to do a project. This is 1983, so when Foucault, in his publications and his lectures, is still concentrating very much on antiquity. Foucault and these students planned to do a project on what they called arts of government in the Great War and the interwar period. And they were going to focus on four countries: France, which was going to be Foucault's, and then Italy, the USA, and the USSR were going to be done by some of these graduate students at Berkeley. Now, Foucault died a few months after this photograph was taken, and so he never returned to Berkeley, and they never completed that work as the collaborative project that they'd intended. But the students that Foucault was working with all published their parts of this project. So Stephen Kotkin, who's now a very distinguished historian of Soviet Russia, just got a recent biography of Stalin that's come out, but wrote a book on Stalinism as a Civilization, which is the book on the USSR. David Horn wrote a book on Italy in that period. Keith Gandel wrote a book on the USA in that period. So the work done by people that were in Foucault's seminar continued that work, and all of them in those books thank Foucault for the initiation of the project and the kind of research mentorship that he provided through that period. This figure at the back there, Jonathan Simon, graduate student at the time, but now a professor of law at Berkeley, had a discussion with Foucault in late 1983, which I found on a tape in the Berkeley archive. And because I'd met Jonathan at a conference, I talked to him and said, you know, why was this never published? And he said, well, I tried to get it published at the time, or not long after Foucault's death, but they said, you talk too much. This is Jonathan Simon. You talk too much. We'd have to build this as Foucault interviews Simon. This wouldn't be much of a selling point. Now, of course, now Jonathan Simon is a distinguished criminologist. He's written a lot about mass incarceration in the US system. Jonathan Simon's much more of a profile figure. And I said, you know, there is a value in this discussion. So we had this transcribed and it was published in Theory, Culture and Society. And there are still these pieces that I find, or that others are finding, of insight into what Foucault is doing. It's a very relaxed conversation rather than a formal interview. And a lot of it is Jonathan Simon saying, this is what I'm interested in and working on. How can I connect this to what you're interested in? And they have a conversation around those kinds of questions. So there's material of that nature that's coming to light. And I've tried to make some of that available as I've gone on. So I said the book became too long. Polity were interested in a book that didn't go massively over the word limit. I got a contract for 90,000 words and I went back to them and said, it's become a bit longer. How's 150,000 words then? And they said no. And initially I thought, oh, this is a real problem because the book works as this integrated study and I'm really loath to break it apart. But eventually what I did was I took two chapters out, wrote a new introduction and gave them this book, which is now very squarely on 74 to 84, the very period of the title. And I took that earlier period from roughly 1969 to 1974-75, and I turned that into a second book. And I did a huge amount of new work and made extensive use of the newly available archive material particularly. It's a book that tries to trace the story from the archaeology of knowledge to discipline and punish. The archaeology of knowledge is Foucault's most dry, tedious, methodological work. Discipline and punish is a politically engaged kind of call to arms. How does Foucault move between those two books? So the early Collège de France lecture courses, Foucault's political activism, and the newly available archive material helped me to try and tell that story. And one of the things I was interested in doing in that story was to try to partner in these last three chapters the more academic work about particular topics and the activist work around those same topics. So while Foucault's work on prison activism is reasonably well known, certainly in France, his work on the health information group is much less known even in France. That material has never been collected in France, and the kind of work that group was doing around immigrant health, around industrial accidents and trying to support workers who were getting poisoned in a car battery factory, for example, the involvement that they had in the French campaign for abortion rights is very important, working with doctors, producing texts and material around that. So I try and tell that story in relation to Foucault's more academic work around the question of health. And so that second book builds on the material that I developed for the first book, but it sets it in a new context. So the books are going to come out in the wrong chronological order, but in a sense they will work together, that this book will lead straight into the Foucault's Last Decade book. Am I doing a Foucauldian project? This is a question I sometimes get asked. The simple answer is no. Foucault didn't write books of the type of nature that I've tried to do in this one. Foucault says at one point when he's getting very frustrated when traditional historians are asking him, you know, are you a proper historian or are you a philosopher or what are you? And he makes this comment, my books aren't treatises in philosophy or studies of history. At most, they are philosophical fragments put to work in the historical field of problems, almost historical building sites or workspaces. My work, I think, is much more traditional history of ideas, intellectual history type of approach. I was very clear I wasn't writing a biography, but I was trying to reconstruct with all the detail that I could what I thought Foucault was trying to do and to tell a story that was fragmented through all of these different sources, these different registers of work, and how these things might connect up to each other. And as I said, it was only intended to be one book, but became two. And I actually wonder if there's actually a third book, which would again work backwards, but would look at Foucault in the 1960s. So looking at the material, the books that he published in the 1960s. The reason I'm not going to write this book anytime soon, other than I'm kind of sick of Foucault and I want to do something else for a bit, is the material just isn't available yet. If you look at the 1970s Foucault and the 1980s Foucault, there's an enormous amount of material published after Foucault's death that I think sheds an enormous amount of light on what Foucault was doing. With the 1960s, at the moment, we still really only have what Foucault published in his own lifetime. But that's going to change. The next programme of work, this I know from the family and from Daniel Defer, is that they're going to try and publish Foucault's early pre-College de France lecture courses. Foucault gave a number of courses in Tunisia in the late 1960s. He gave some courses in between 69 and 70 at Vincennes, which was a new post-May 68 university set up in France, to kind of house all of the radical problems of French intellectuals and to try and allow students to do a different set of courses there. Foucault gave some courses there that I think are interesting. And so there's this material, and possibly also from the École Normale Supérieure in the 1950s. I've read student notes, student audience member notes of Foucault's lectures from the 1950s, but if any of you have ever seen undergraduate notes left after one of your lectures, you'll know that these are not always the most reliable guide of what was actually said. So those courses, when they actually publish them, and the plan is they will continue the College de France series and go backwards to that earlier period. And that's why I think they've kept so much of the archive inaccessible. They're going through all of the material they think might have publishable material in it in order that they can publish it before they make that available to researchers. So it's one or the other. Either they publish the material or they open up the archive, and I suspect opening up the archive is dependent on publishing everything they can that they think is worthwhile from that. The other thing, though, I'm interested in is how did Foucault write History of Madness? And he spent much of the time outside of France, particularly in Uppsala in Sweden. And I'm interested in looking at the collection in Uppsala and working with the material that Foucault used to write that History of Madness at that period. Because if there's one kind of guiding theme to what I'm doing in these books, is not to read people who have read Foucault, but to read what Foucault read. I'm much less interested in the secondary debates and all of the applications about Foucault and trying to work out what Foucault himself was reading and how he was making connections, drawing ideas together, and so on. And in a sense, that's why I've kept working backwards and kept thinking through those questions, and why the reading notes in Paris have been so useful in terms of this is what Foucault was reading, these are the references that he was engaging with, the literature that he was thinking about at that time. And I will stop there. Thank you.